how to start?
Well, you know, it's just writing. I mean,
here's something important to remember about dialogue.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
I want to go to this place that I think it needs to go to.
The only thing that counts is what you see on the screen.
I will write like 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
And it will be a voice made of ink and rage.
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Welcome back to the show. In this episode, I sat down with Don McKellar to talk about the new HBO series, The Sympathizer. The plot reads, near the end of the Vietnam War, a plant who was embedded in the South Vietnam Army flees to the United States and takes up residence in a refugee community where he continues to secretly spy and report back to the Viet Cong. In this interview, we talk about adapting The Sympathizer from the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, explaining history so everyone understands both sides of the very complicated war in Vietnam, how to create automatic tension based around the tagline refugee, traitor, hero, spy, what it's like to be a showrunner, and the importance of collaboration. This interview is also on the Creative Screenwriting website. Here's my conversation with Don McKellar.
I grew up in Toronto. I didn't think being a movie director was really an option. It never occurred to me. There was Cronenberg, not many other examples that I knew of, at least. But I did love theater. My parents, I was lucky that they took me to a lot. So in high school, I founded a children's theater company to pay my way through university. We toured around with my friends. We created shows together. And that was the first time I, all the disciplines, writing, we wrote, performed, and directed our own shows. So they all got blended together to me. And so I didn't really start with acting. I was acting in high school, but I was also writing, sort of. I was doing collective shows, and then I founded my own theater company, and we wrote and acted and directed. And then I was hired to write a movie by Bruce McDonald. And that sort of drew me into the writing side. And lo and behold, the possibility of a career in the movies and television seemed like a possibility.
Did those like live performances and that, you know, instant audience feedback, did that change your writing or the way you think about the audience or the material you work on?
Yeah, definitely. I co-wrote a musical called The Drowsy Chaperone on Broadway, and we did previews. And in that kind of show, yes, it's obvious. You do a joke, it doesn't work. You try another one the next night, it works better. That's really obvious. What I think helps is, as a writer, having that actor side as an ingrained in my bones, you can sort of feel this works. This could play. This would be enjoyable to deliver. I think that sort of instinct is really informs my writing. I like to do stuff that I think actors will enjoy, and consequently viewers will enjoy. I think that is, you know, helped me work with Robert, for instance, in this show.
How did you guys kind of get together? How did you first meet, or were you brought in for the project? What were some of the logistics of like you coming onto the project?
I mean, I'd written a screenplay many years ago with Park Chan-wook that was never made and may now be made. But we really had a fun time working together. We felt that we sort of naturally shared a lot of taste issues. We liked odd stuff, but we also liked entertaining people. We liked getting reactions out of viewers. So we worked together well, I think. Even though he doesn't speak English perfectly, we felt we could finish each other's sentences. So that was fun. So when this project came up and Viet revealed to one of our producers, Neve Fishman, that Park Chan-wook was one of the inspirations for the book. He thought, okay, what about getting those two guys, me and Chan-wook, together and put them together as a team? And Chan-wook really liked the idea because he'd done a TV series before, a Little Drama Girl. He knew the pain showrunners go through. So he thought, okay, I could use support. And he really encouraged the idea of this co-showrunner model.
Where do you start with an adaptation? Like, what's the first thing you do?
Well, I guess it depends on the book. I mean, this book is not, it's an amazing book and it's a Pulitzer Prize winning book and it's sort of very daunting in that way, but it's not internal musings, you know, it's not descriptions of room. It's not Proustian or anything like that. It's quite action packed. He's telling a story. He wants to entertain. It's intelligent. It's sort of, there's a dialectic play between of ideas, but it also plays with genre. The character himself, it's told in first person, is loves American pop culture, loves the movies. So it allows you to embrace that side of it, to play the genre conventions, to be playful about storytelling, because that's partly what it's about. And so this film, it evolved naturally, sort of by doing what was fun or we thought would surprise or titillate ourselves. And then it developed surprisingly naturally.
Did you always know it was going to be 7 episodes? Like, how do you start to make some of those decisions?
Yeah, it's funny. I sort of just broke it down casually to myself, by myself, just said, okay, this is what feels like the shape of the arc over 8 episodes. And then I met with Vian and I remember saying, this sort of 7th episode, the 6th and 7th, is a bit of a filler there. I'll come up with something, because the rest was pretty action packed and pretty incident filled. And he said, does it have to be 8 episodes? And I said, no, let me think about that. I guess not. It can be 7. And I asked A24, I guess they were on at the time. They went, it can be 7. Sure. So we decided, well, let's fit it in at 7. So I guess you have to sort of just feel that out and feel. I knew I wanted it to be dense. I wanted a lot of stuff to be happening. I wanted it to be fairly fast. And I wanted multiple competing storytelling devices. And I wanted that complexity. So it couldn't allow for a lot of filler. You know, it wasn't the kind of show where you can hate. And it's very subjective too. So it's not like, what if Lana meets the professor? That kind, you know, like, it's not that kind of show. We wanted it to be tight. And working with Director Park, he's very economical. He doesn't like anything repeated. So it just felt 7. We'll go with 7.
What were some of the problems with a storyline like this, where maybe you feel like you're having to explain certain parts to Americans, if that makes sense? Like, is that something that you kind of have to do or think about, or how do you think about those things?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of history, and I realized at the beginning, well, I'm never going to explain the Vietnam War, because it's pretty almost impossible to explain, like any war, I suppose. The more you explain, the more questions arise. It's a problematic war in the first place. That was one of the reasons people protested it. So it's like not easy to lay out the framework in an easy to digest way. But I mean, I remember saying in the room and to HBO early on, well, you know, they would ask, why do you use these military terms? It's a bit confusing. And it's like, well, you know, they're military. It's like a medical show. You know, we don't know what they're talking about specifically. We know they're talking about the problem and they're trying to solve it using the tools of the trade. And so the military is a bit like that. Even the history is a bit like that. I think the fundamental history is what people need at the to appreciate the show and get into the show is really very little. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because depressingly, these wars since then for the next 50 years have all been similar. American foreign policy lessons have been similar war after war. Their sort of failures have been similar war after war. So I think viewers know more than they think. Even if they think they know nothing about the Vietnam War, they've absorbed a lot.
And there's something like the military watching it. They do care about that. Like my wife's a nurse and it drives her crazy when they make giant mistakes on those shows.
Of course. And we had military advisors, because obviously you're right. You can't fluff that stuff. You can't play around with uniforms, for instance. You can't just make that up. So, yeah. The good thing about this is we had every day on set a Vietnamese guy who knew that army, like there's still people around from that. We still had living history to talk to in the room. And of course it's but obviously you just have to defer to authority on that stuff.
Right.
And historically too. You just have to get the best research and the best advice as possible.
How do you work with researchers? Do you plot out the best story you can and then ask, very specific questions as you need them? Or
Well, fortunately, in this case, Viet had done a lot of that work beforehand for the novel, and he'd talked to veterans and done a huge amount of research historically too. So that was fantastic. It was fantastic that we had this great relationship with Viet and that he was involved all the way through. And I could email him and say, is there some, like, did any bombs fall 3 days before that kind of question. Yeah. When I needed something historically. And we had other people like that too. But I would say it goes both ways. Sometimes you learn great things from history. I read lots of memoirs of survivors of re-education camps. I read lots of sort of academic things about refugees and their settlement in California. There's a huge amount of material out there. Sometimes you use it to bolster your what you already have and find ways of justifying what you wrote, but other ways you're surprised by it and inspired to come up with something. And that happened with our cast too, because our cast all, and even in the audition process, it became clear they had incredible knowledge, family history. Some of them, like Tuan, who played the general, came over to Fort Chaffee as a kid. I remember when that came up, I said, well, what do you remember? And he said, I remember Wonder Bread. There were racks of Wonder Bread that they bought in, and we'd never seen anything like that kind of bread. And I remember the red dots, and I was like, well, we got to do that. And I called the art director, and we have a bunch of Wonder Bread in the back of the canteen. But those sort of details that you would never, ever, ever write. The cast were an incredible resource, and just seeing them fill it with not only their acting skills, but their sort of memories and their family history was really exciting.
So the tagline, I guess you'd say, is like refugee, traitor, hero, spy. So with all that packed into a character, there's automatically some tension. Can you talk about writing tension or how you think about tension in stories?
Yeah. I mean, I do believe that. I do believe, and especially for a spy thing, it's key. Park Chan-wook, right from the beginning, wanted us to push or just keep alive the genre aspects. He really loves espionage. He's a huge fan of Le Carré and the genre. Yeah, what it really is keeping the viewer unsettled. And with a spy thing, it's really fundamentally an identity question. Will he be found out? And with the captain, the whole spy question, the whole genre aspect has been completely internalized. And he actually has that conflict within himself, which was a real gift because it meant we didn't have to build artificial constructions on the outside. We, to challenge, you know, his identity, we really allowed the writers to go inside and have him fight those battles between his own conflicting sides and find out for himself who the real captain was. So his spyness is his flaw, right? His two-facedness is both his gift and his curse. So I think that's the way we tried to keep it from becoming too mechanical in a spy way. We tried to make the duality a character issue.
Were there any other books or films that you talked about as far as like finding the tone for the story in addition to the novel?
Yeah, well, I mean, we read a lot of stuff. As a room, I remember, I mean, one of the things is this book is intentionally flipping the narrative on at least Americans' perception of the war, which is mostly based on movies and television, particularly movies, which is unique about the Vietnam War, I think. So I think that the book is consciously saying, well, let's look at this from the other side. So that was sort of a real motivation when we were writing. It was sort of like a tool we had just to say, okay, but what's the other side? And once you find the other side, you say, well, what's the other side of that? Because this is a Vietnam War story, not told from the American perspective, but from the Vietnamese perspective. But then that perspective also has two sides.
With something like this, and it may go back to the original material, do you feel like you're trying to provide any answers, or is it more like kind of shining a light on questions, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, yeah. That's a very perceptive question, because the book is sort of didactic in a way. Viet doesn't shy away from that. He feels that a lot of modern art unnecessarily turns away from political questions and sort of ideological questions. But at the same time, in the book and in the series, I think it's very hard to pin down exactly what his politics is, because he's satirical both on every direction. And the show is really about the dialectic. It's like saying these two sides exist, and the only way we're going to reconcile them is through some sort of synthesis, like showing both sides honestly, throwing them up against each other. And hopefully that forces a kind of modesty and objectivity that allows a more profound empathy. And sort of, so I guess what I'm saying in a short answer is, yeah, we weren't really trying to provide the answers. We were giving a perspective for viewers to watch from and allowing them to make their own judgments based on that novel perspective.
Do you sort of hope that people get different conclusions from that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the captain is an anti-hero and a hero, but it depends on which side of the war you are, which is which. They're both valid. Like, he's genuinely conflicted. He genuinely is both. And so it's trite to say, oh, this side was right. This side won over. In a way, his pure emotional side, his love for his friends, is what trumps his ideological conflict. That's ultimately in the room. That's where the heart of the show is, of course, amongst these friends. And that's what makes us love the captain, but it's also his downfall as a spy and what ends him up in trouble. So, but that's something that's easier to identify with.
When Robert Downey Jr. got involved, did anything change about the script? Did you have any idea what all he would be doing? How do you, any other thoughts about writing for him?
I mean, I loved him, and I was thrilled by that he was doing it. And I guess I have, like everyone, a sort of preconception of what he can do well and what kind of stuff he. So maybe I leaned into that a little. He liked the script straight from the start. He did say, okay, Don, one day I got the message he wants to meet with you. I was scared, of course. And we had an amazing time. He threw out some crazy ideas, some crazy references. He said, this character could go like this, like that, like, and he was very entertaining and funny. But at the end of the session, I thought, am I supposed to write that, put that in the script? What am I supposed to do with that? It was completely entertaining, but it was kind of nutty. I didn't know how to use it necessarily. And I thought about it. I was afraid. I remember thinking, what do I do? What do I do? And then finally, I thought, I got a message. Oh, he's waiting to see the new draft. And I thought, okay. And then I sort of went with it, and I sort of took some of his ideas. I didn't exactly put them in the script, but I used them to sort of liberate myself to do some, to take some big swings that I thought he would enjoy. And he did. And then he read it. It's like, all right, I love it. So I think that's the best option, you know, like he was definitely didn't dictate lines. I think some people maybe feel that he's going to just sort of run roughshod over a production. I think some people assume that's what he did, but he really didn't. It was funny. I was just talking to him last night. He was very professional, actually. Of course he had tons of ideas. Of course, he came up with hilarious improvs, but really only in service of the script, sort of in the way an actor should, in the way you hope an actor will embrace the part, fully commit to the set, to the story. So it ended up being a bit of a dream.
When you're going into a conversation like that, maybe not that one in particular, do you have a North Star that drives you through the whole thing, so you know when to say yes, when to say no, when to say maybe?
Oh, wow. That's a really tough question. Because it's always in your mind, right? The funny thing is, with Chen Wook and I, we were co-showrunners. Of course, I had to do a lot of the diplomacy, which is probably his plan right from the start, to get someone to do that for him. It's partly his excuse was, of course, the language. Oh, you can deal with the network notes better than I can, that kind of thing. But it meant I had to do a lot of that negotiation. And you always do wonder, how much do you defend your preconceptions or where you were going with the scripts? I did learn from Chen Wook that actually he was always open to a new smart idea. I think people were intimidated by him and afraid to give suggestions, but in the end, I would say that he's almost frustratingly open to a good idea. So I did try and be open. I tried to be open to the network ideas. Of course, there were a couple of things that I knew we would never compromise on. We would never have Vietnamese characters not speaking Vietnamese, for instance. There was quite a few plot things that we were stubborn about. But at the same time, I did try and be open. At the end, HBO took me out to dinner and said, "Don, thank you for explaining things to us. Often writers don't explain things." And I said, "Oh, that's good," because I was worried that I was just defensively justifying everything we'd written. But I do think sometimes writers are afraid to be open about your reasons and your motivations. And when you do explain things, often you're explaining them to yourself in a way that helps you articulate what's important and what you're going to hold on to, and alternatively, what's not important and what might be confusing. So I do believe in talking, you know, like being open about your process and motivation. I feel one thing I definitely learned from this, that it never helps to be sort of secretive about what you want.
After a project like this, where there's so much work goes into it, how do you kind of think about what's next? Do you feel like each project should give you some new level of responsibility, or how do you think about those things?
Oh man, you picked the you picked the moment where that's what I'm thinking about, right? Like, I mean, this has been so much work. I can't tell you. I'm sure you have an idea, but it's really hard to think about anything else. And I think you can make a mistake of, as you see the end coming, making an impulsive decision. Next, I've got to do something. I got to line up something right away. I'm trying not to be impulsive, and to sit back and say, what have I learned? What has it opened in me? Do I want to go back to that project I wrote 6 years ago that I never got going, you know? Or have I genuinely moved on? But I think for the answer to this question, you'll have to come back to me in 5 months or something. I don't know right now.
We just got a few minutes left. I feel like a lot of your answers, or maybe the questions I'm asking, a lot of the breadcrumbs are about like collaborating well. Do you have any advice for new writers about collaborating well, finding kindred spirits, that kind of thing?
Well, it's everything. I mean, in my career, and I'm sure most people would say the same thing, it's all about collaborating. Certainly that's what show running is. People have maybe the opposite opinion sometimes, that it's sort of this sort of commanding auteurish presence that has to dictate the terms, but absolutely fundamental is collaboration. You have to enjoy that. If you want to do the job, some people don't enjoy it. I often hear showrunners whining and think, well, why did you even want to do this job then? Because that's what it is. And unless you get pleasure. But I told you when I went right from the beginning, your very first question, those kids that I formed a theater company, did pay my way through university, did children's theater. We stuck together. And years later, wrote a musical and all won Tonys together because I kept up those relationships and I enjoyed working with them. And at least I'm the kind of person that it's not just pleasure. I feed off of other people's. My best moments in writing this show were moments where I thought, yes, this is a total Park Chan-wook idea. He's going to love this. And I would give it to him, and he would never give it to me. He would always go, yes, it's good, but I think like this. That's when I knew it was going to work, you know, when he tried to trump me. But I love those moments, you know. Unless you can get pleasure out of helping other people succeed and bringing out the best in them, then it really isn't the job. Then you should at least not show running. You can still write, but even in the room, you know, like, that's the fun of it. So I don't know why you wouldn't do that.
Thanks so much for tuning into the show. Before you take off, I want to give you a free gift. I'm giving you my first book, Ink by the Barrel, for free. That's the digital download and audiobook at brockswenson.com.
Inside this book, you learn how to annihilate writer's block by embracing Elizabeth Gilbert's playful trickster mentality. You can learn to weaponize your anxiety with Kevin Kelly's different is better approach, and learn how to defend your time with Ryan Holiday's calendar anorexia mindset. There's just a few other ideas in the book, Ink by the Barrel. It's also based on over 400 interviews I've done right here on Creative Principles. So go steal that book right now, Ink by the Barrel, to learn how to be a prolific writer. You can get your copy, that's digital download and audiobook, at brockswinson.com, brockswinson.com. And if it's your first time here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode.